It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eric Peden. Dr. Peden graduated from UT at Southwestern. He then completed a general surgery residency at the University of Texas at Houston, and then a vascular surgery fellowship at Rush Presbyterian Hospital. You know, someone once said you really cannot take the measure of a man by what he says, but rather by what he does. And I was most impressed when I was reading Dr. Peden's CV that he worked in Sri Lanka in 2000 with a group that some of you may have heard of, Doctors Without Borders. You know, they won the Nobel Prize several years ago. And it's always been one of my dreams to go and work with Doctors Without Borders. So my hat's certainly off to you, Dr. Peden. And he is going to discuss some new aspects about veins. And I asked him if veins were important, and I think he's going to answer that question. Eric?
Thank you.
So that was a great comment about Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. Unfortunately, they won the Nobel Prize the year before I went, so it was really hell, actually, getting into their system and getting going. But it was a fabulous experience. I would recommend it. Of course, you do need a pretty good chunk of time. So I'm filling in for Alan Lumsden, giving the talk today. And when asked what would be new, I think venous disease is really sort of the redheaded stepchild of vascular surgery. And in every book, it's full of arterial disease. And at the very back, there's a few pages on venous disease and maybe half a page on, or a paragraph on, lymphatic problems. So it's really, though, coming to the forefront. Now it's got its own meetings, its own societies, its own journals, et cetera. And I think really bringing to light some of their problems is big and worthwhile. So I have a rather hopeful agenda, which perhaps we won't make it all through, but we'll give it a shot. And what I'd like to talk about is interventional treatment for DVT. I think it's probably underutilized. Advanced venous insufficiency, terrible disease. Hopefully we never get it. Of the couple things I take care of and never want to get, this is one of them. And then a new trial for superficial venous incompetence, just so we have time at the end. So interventional treatment for DVT, it's a big problem, obviously, DVTs, right? There are tons of them that happen around. If you look at this on a national level, organizations have identified venous thromboembolic problems as one of the number one preventable causes of in-hospital death that really should be taken care of. So getting increasing attention, and the long-term sequela of significant DVTs are really a bane of our existence, and we'll go into that a little bit more. The primary goal, of course, when you're treating DVTs is not to let them have a PE. That's the life-threatening part. It's unusual for them to progress on to limb-threatening disease, but it can happen with phlegmasia. So your secondary goals are, of course, relief of their acute symptomatology that brings them in, prevention of propagation, which can make it considerably worse, and then hopefully reducing the post-thrombotic syndrome that can happen and recurrences, which are a big problem as well. So before I start on my stuff, though, I'll just say, just right out, that truly the standard of care for DVTs is anticoagulation. And we get frequently asked, you know, can we just get a filter or something? Can we do this or that? Kind of no matter what else we do, really the patient needs to be treated with anticoagulation if at all possible. And if you're going to take anything home from it, I'd say you got to take that home. Because whatever fancy stuff we do for the clots, the patient really needs anticoagulation. But in fact, it's a little more advanced than that, right? And if you look at the American College of Chest Physicians, and I think they do a great review, and in their review, what they've come up with is also their other grade one recommendation is, in addition to anticoagulation, really early compression helps. So early compression, early ambulation are also shown to increase and improve your venous physiology afterwards and decrease your rates of post-thrombotic syndrome afterwards. We know that the faster you get to full anticoagulation, the better protected you are. So the advancement with low molecular weight heparins and the predictable dosing and response of that has really been an advance, and is something that's changed, of course, the way we do things. So now it seems like most patients seem to be treated as an outpatient for venous thromboembolic problems and do quite well from that. Highly effective, of course, at preventing worsening of the DVTs or preventing pulmonary emboli. Depending on the duration, whether or not they get recurrence is another issue. And if you wait long enough, the veins will recanalize in the great majority of cases. The problem is, though, that it's really prophylactic therapy, right? It's trying to prevent the next worst thing from happening, whether that be extension of their clot or an embolus of their clot, et cetera, and doesn't remove the offending clot. Now, certainly the body has mechanisms going on to both make and break the clot, and then you're arresting part of that process and letting them recanalize. But the problem is that very few of them of significant extensive DVTs will recanalize within the early period. And if you wait, then the valves become permanently damaged, and that leads to the long-term problems. And normal valves down below the level of obstruction also with time will degenerate and become incompetent. So the long-term sequelae really seem to be related to what happens to the valves. It's not always just what happens to the proximal DVT or the occluded vein itself, but what happens downstream. And if the popliteal vein becomes involved or gets involved later as sort of one of the gatekeeper veins, then it's a real problem. And if your distal veins remain normal, then the great majority of people will be symptom-free. If the distal veins become abnormal and develop reflux over time, then the majority of those patients will have symptoms. So the post-thrombotic symptoms, again, seem to be related to two things. One is residual obstruction, because although you'll recanalize, it's not usually recanalized to where it's completely normal and completely free of any disease or obstruction. It's still got some partial obstruction. And then it renders the valves incompetent, which is a big problem. And this is, of course, one of the worst manifestations, where you have painful ulcerations, weeping, and the hyperpigmentation, obstructive changes. The combination of the reflux and obstruction really leads to the worst. If you look at the American College of Chest Physicians and their recommendations, they pretty well go deadhead against thrombolysis or aggressive interventions for DVTs in the absence of somebody who is showing signs of phlegmasia. So they say essentially they'll just reserve it for limb salvage. And the problem is that, of course, they're trying to go for our level one data. They're trying to go for all randomized controlled trials, and there really just aren't enough in vascular surgery outside of carotid disease to really make us a real scientific society. So their points are it's less safe, certainly more invasive and higher risk, and then puts everybody else at risk and is more costly to do that. So is it bad care? Is it universally true? Well, I'd say no. And we'll kind of go through some of the scenarios. So clearly the post-thrombotic syndromes are worse in the patients that have the more extensive clots. So the patients that have an iliofemoral DVT that is extending all the way from the iliacs down to the popliteal or into the tibials have their biggest problems. And they get the recurrent thromboses, and they're the ones who are a big setup for these lifelong problems. Manifestations, the pain, the swelling, the skin changes are really disabling and disable probably more people, in fact, than arterial disease do in terms of our working population. So many years ago, it was shown actually that a big surgery doing an iliofemoral thrombectomy actually wound up doing better for the patient in terms of relieving their symptomatology acutely and then preventing the post-thrombotic syndrome. The trouble is, it's a big surgery. It certainly has a definable mortality. And with long-term patency being in question with a couple of studies, it has been all but abandoned here in the U.S. except for a few cases of phlegmasia. So the evolution then went from the thrombectomy to thrombolysis. And the early studies were on systemic thrombolysis, then flow-directed thrombolysis, which is a little vague, catheter-directed thrombolysis, which is really where we currently are, adding in mechanical, and then adding the two together for pharmacomechanical thrombolysis. So systemic thrombolysis, whether you call it flow-directed or systemic, can be delivered through a foot IV or an arm IV. Intuitively, you'd think that putting it in the foot would do better, but in fact, it tends to flow right through the open veins and not get down in the occluded veins, and just winds up being systemic thrombolytics and doesn't really do any better than just putting it in through the arm. So overall, systemic thrombolysis was shown to be better than anticoagulation alone in terms of getting a patent vein. The two, again, were essentially equal in terms of delivering it locally or delivering it through an arm or remotely. And then we round up that the rate of post-thrombotic syndrome was inversely related to how much clot you had left, or directly related to that. So the more clot you have left and the more obstruction you have, then the bigger problems you have with valvular incompetence down the line and the bigger problems you have with post-thrombotic syndromes. But in reviewing studies, the meta-analyses have shown that when you get complete or significant lysis, it happens much more often in the thrombolytic group than it does in the patients with just anticoagulation. But some real problems from that. And there is a real significant incidence of major hemorrhage. And some of these can be pretty devastating. So sort of onto the better mousetrap. The next thing became then, perhaps instead of using the mega doses that people were initially using on MIs and DVTs like this, is to actually put a catheter directly into the clot and perfuse the thrombolytics directly there. By doing that, you can increase the efficacy of that, decrease the dose, and decrease the time. And then overall, it seems like we're decreasing the complication rate some. So several single-center trials have shown that that improves things, and there's actually been one randomized trial that did show that you improve patency considerably over anticoagulation alone, and that long-term that leads to decreased post-thrombotic problems. There is a multi-center venous registry, which is really our biggest source of data in terms of number of patients, outcomes, et cetera, that we really use for talking to patients about the risks, et cetera. Not randomized, but sort of a big group of physicians all over the country that got together and said, okay, here are sort of the protocols we're going with. Let's look and see how this is done. This is mostly done with urokinase when that was widely available, and now, of course, we've shifted primarily to TPA. So the venous registry data was really for thrombolytic of all significant DVTs of these different centers. And what it wound up showing, though, was that it's really the acute iliofemoral DVT that responded the best, with the best patency rates and the most improvement in quality of life afterwards. And then the post-thrombotic syndrome compared to controls was reduced from 60% down to about 25 or 30%. So patients that had chronic DVTs over 30 days, over 60 days, et cetera, really didn't do too well. The patients with just ephemeral popliteal DVT did better, but not anywhere near as significant as the patients that extended all the way up into the iliac veins. Can we make it even better, though? So the problem is, though, we're infusing this potentially dangerous drug into patients, sometimes for 48, 72 hours at a time, and can we do something to hasten that along? So a variety of mechanical devices have been developed, and there's probably about a dozen on the market that can be used to try and extract clot. Most of these get approved through the routes of dialysis access, declotting procedures, and then get sort of advanced on off-label, et cetera. But the ones that we'll talk about are actually FDA approved. So the mechanism of these different devices is usually either aspiration of the clot or microfragmentation, so breaking it down to small enough fragments that it's not a real problem. When combined with thrombolytics is termed pharmacomechanical thrombolysis, and this is really where the state of the art is today for venous thrombolysis. So we get to combine the thrombolytic infusion with mechanical energy. We increase the penetration of the thrombolytics into the clot, and we reduce the burden of the clot, and hopefully by that reduce the time that's needed for overall treatment. And sometimes it can actually eliminate the time you need to spend in ICU doing it. Equally important, though, of removing the clot is looking for an underlying source, because what we know is that for the majority of these patients will find some underlying anatomic problem that needs to be corrected. And we'll go into that. So Mathurner is probably the thing we find the most commonly, and this is where the left iliac vein is compressed by the right iliac artery. It's the most common variant of that. It can happen on the right and the left, but the most common is the left. And what we know is that if you look at autopsy series that were done by the guys originally, you'll find that this is in 22% of patients. There was a study that came out of Chicago a couple of years ago that said incidental finding of this in trauma CTs was about 30%. Obviously, 30% of people aren't walking around with a left leg DVT, but if we look at where do people's venous problems come up? If you have an isolated leg with venous pathology, it's a left leg in two-thirds or more of the time. So if somebody has varicosities, et cetera, the great majority of time, if it's isolated one leg, it's in the left. And we think that this is part of it. So it's an acquired lesion from chronic compression, leads to some scarring and spurs, et cetera, and can come in with left leg pain, sort of the venous claudication where the leg's a little heavy, a little tight, doesn't look too bad. Sometimes it's swollen, or in the worst cases, it can come in with DVT. Women, we think, are at greater risk because during pregnancy, the uterus is putting additional pressure on the vein as it crosses from one side to the other. So with this, you can see that here's the aorta coming down, splitting to the right and left iliac veins. The cava's here on the right side, splitting. And you can see right here where they cross. And if you take out the aorta, in fact, that's where you see the compression. And that's exactly what your venograms will look like as well. Just run through a case study. So a patient comes in with acute right leg swelling, tight calf, bluish discoloration, and tenderness. And you can see, this is one of the hallmarks, is that the swelling extends all the way up to the top of the thigh. If it's just calf, probably not this extensive of a clot. If it's swollen all the way to the thigh, something's going on up top. You almost guarantee that. And if you look down at the leg, you can see certainly the discoloration, the swollen calf. So for this patient, the plan then was to place a temporary filter, which I would say is done in about half of the cases. If you pull sort of experts across the country at the big meetings, about half will do this, about half will not. We do know that if you retrieve the filter and you look inside of it, you'll see clot in many of the patients. However, if you look for symptomatic pulmonary emboli, the incidence is no different with thrombolysis than it is without it. So it's a little bit of a sort of mystery still exactly which way to go for that. A right iliofemoral DVT thrombectomy was planned. using AngioJet, which is one of the devices we'll talk about, using tissue plasminogen activator, or TPA, and it's usually done through a right popliteal approach. To do that, we have to flip the patient prone. So the AngioJet system is one of the thromboaspiration catheters, and it works on the Venturi effect. So what happens is it generates a high stream of flow that goes from one hole to the other. And in doing that, it creates a circular flow pattern, which sucks in additional material around it. And at the conferences, they're always showing you in this little bowl of Jell-O how this thing sucks up the red Jell-O with it. And for a pretty fresh clot, it can work fairly well. If it's clot that's been there for a while, then it's usually a little too firm to get through these holes. So here's sort of the scenario of where it is. So we've gone into the operating room, the ultrasound's used to direct imaging and get a puncture in, and then ultimately we've got a sheath entering the popliteal vein. And then what we see on our initial venogram is that there is extensive clot going all the way up with lack of filling, etc. So one of the ways to hasten this process is to infuse the fluid through the AngioJet, but not let it come back out. And by doing this, then we're doing what we call pulse spray or power spraying into the clot. So the stuff's coming out at a fairly good force. And what we'll do is just spray the TPA, so spray 5 to 10 milligrams of TPA up and down the clot, and then wait. And wait for about 20 minutes or so, longer if you can take it, less if you can't, while that thing is sitting there soaking. And then go back in and aspirate afterwards and turn on the effluent so that you can get clot back out. So we penetrate deeply into the clot as best we can. We wait a little while to give the TPA time to work. The half-life of the TPA is very short. And then go in and suck the clot out as best we can. So in doing this, then, the clot is all sprayed, and we wait for a period of about 20 minutes or so. And you can see already you've got some recanalization. Keep going up. And then now we've gone up and sprayed. And then after that, then come back and suck. And afterwards, this is a little bit out of sequence, this side has already been discovered to have a stenosis up here in the iliac vein, very similar to the Mathurin, not quite as high as what we'd see more typically. And this has already been stented and now is being angioplastied. And then afterwards, after all the clot is sucked out, then we can see that now we've restored a fairly widely patent lumen all the way down. And what you can see is that in the patient over the next few days, that the swelling usually goes from pretty dramatic to pretty close to normal. Now, this is a little unusual, and this is done in a single state, in a single setting, is that the patient's clot was fresh enough that with the pulse spray and then the suction aspiration method of the AngioJet catheter, we're able to get that out and not have to go to the ICU, fix it all in one stop, and then not have to go back and forth. But more typical, I would say, is that the patient has to go to ICU, has to continue thrombolytics overnight, but you hasten that process by doing that. Just another brief case is a young woman with renal failure who's got dialysis in her left arm, now comes in with a big-time swollen arm. And then if you look at the venogram, shows something pretty dramatic. Same basic techniques used. And then afterwards, restoring flow. Again, looking for a central lesion, which is then treated and stented, and that helps improve our long-term efficacy. It takes a few days for the arm or the leg to go down. Point of this being, it's not just for the legs. It can be pretty dramatic impact in the arms as well. If it's just mild, something in the arm from subclavian catheter or something, many times that will get better. If it's something pretty dramatic like this, then this can help dramatically and get the patients less symptomatic much more quickly. So some more tools. There, of all the devices I was talking about, we sort of moved through several. One of the problems with the device I was just showing is that it requires a fair amount of fluoro time and operating room time. Because you're going in, you're sucking, and you're ballooning, and you're sucking, and you're ballooning, and you're going back and forth. You're letting the TPA dissolve the clot while you're waiting there, and the kind of time's going on, et cetera, and the fluoro time's building up, et cetera. There's a new device that's been recently approved, which is called the Echo System. And this is based off the power of delivering regional ultrasound into the clot to loosen up fibrin strands, break down the clot some, at the same time being combined with thrombolytic therapy. It's being used for strokes, and it's being used also in the periphery. So along the catheter, it has several places where ultrasound energy is transmitted like this. And then that combined with the TPA, it's thought to soften the clot, drive the TPA a little further in, et cetera. And one of the company's sort of standpoints is that it actually allows them to soften clot behind the valves, which is frequently an area that's hard to get any real activity in terms of getting any suction going on to get those valves cleared out from behind. Because the clot many times tends to start behind the valves, and if nothing else, you'll have residual clot there. So it's been thought that it's going to help a little bit more with getting more thorough cleaning. And in fact, if you compare it against the venous registry and then other centers, it's found that for a complete lysis that it does considerably better. So combining the two together has reduced the cost in terms of requiring prolonged periods of thrombolytics. It's hastened the time, it's decreased our radiation exposure and our OR times, and really has helped. And we think that it's going to decrease our risk from the thrombolytics to some degree. But again, the job's not quite done yet. When you're looking at this and you just suck out of the clot, you have to go back and look for other issues with the vein, because sometimes the venous lesions and outflow problems can be a little bit subtle. If you look at this, you might think that's just a little piece of bowel or something else that's obstructing that or causing a subtraction artifact. But if you do rotational views, then you can see that it's actually very tightly compressed right there. And if you put up a balloon, there are some people who do a balloon as an inflation as a test to see if there's stenosis. You can see a fairly tight wasting of the balloon, which then inflates nicely afterwards and is stented open. And then you need to extend the stent all the way up into the vena cava so that you make sure we get well straddled across the lesion on both sides to where it's normal. Here's a case where it's fairly obvious that there's fairly bad obstruction. And one of the other tools that really helps us determine in some of the milder cases is intravascular ultrasound. So we can see where the vein is nice and normal. In the areas where the vein is all compressed, here we see that this is fairly normal looking vessel, but here it's much lighter and is not as dark as we'd like to see for normal blood. And then again, here it's full of sort of some fibrotic material and compressed. And then down below, it's open. This helps us with sizing, et cetera, and can help direct our therapy. One of the problems is frequently that this problem extends further down, and we not infrequently have to stent down across the inguinal ligament, but really for long-term patency, that seems to not be a big impact. The bigger impact is leaving a lesion that's not adequately treated. That's certain to fail. Potential complications are important. The thrombolytics certainly are a fairly powerful drug and have real issues. Access site bleeding, fortunately, is one of our more common problems if we're going to have problems. Retroperitoneal bleeding can be a big deal. GI or GU bleeding, frequently we'll see what we think is GU bleeding because during the thrombolytic process, particularly if we're using the AngioJet, that leads to some hemolysis, which then leads to bloody-looking urine, but it's not actually cells, it's just free hemoglobin, usually adequate hydration, sometimes alkalinization is needed. Pulmonary embolism we certainly worry about, but again, not any higher in this patient population with this therapy than anticoagulation alone. And hemorrhagic stroke is the devastating one. So intracranial hemorrhage is by far and away the most feared complication because as it happens, it's usually fatal. Unfortunately, it's difficult to predict. In the days when we were doing systemic thrombolytics, the incidence was higher. Now with catheter-directed thrombolysis, et cetera, the incidence is less than 1%, but still not zero. So we usually tell people about 0.5%. So 1 in 200 could have this. Fortunately, knock on wood, hasn't happened here yet, but certainly would be a devastating complication to have. So in terms of thinking about these patients and who would benefit, who wouldn't benefit, certainly have to think about the contraindications. If the person's had a recent stroke or spinal or cranial surgery recently, then we won't do it. Active bleeding obviously is a real problem, although we have actually done patients that have had menorrhagia, et cetera, and have not had real problems. Recent major surgery would certainly be a contraindication because you don't want to induce a big thrombolytic state in the retroperitoneum or somewhere else. Relative contraindication is if somebody's had a GI bleed previously, a previous stroke, we're not really quite sure what to do with this. Uncontrolled hypertension is something we worry about, and we want to get the blood pressure down. If it remains uncontrolled, we won't do it, and that's from the coronary data. And then if somebody's had extremity surgery recently, we try not to do it, although occasionally we have, and sometimes we had to go back for bleeding problems from that. So I'd say, in summary, anticoagulation alone is effective therapy for preventing the propagation of most patients, for preventing the pulmonary emboli, but really does not alleviate the symptoms quickly and certainly doesn't prevent post-thrombotic syndrome as well as thrombolysis can for the really extensive ones. Pharmacomechanical thrombolysis offers the opportunity to get things done quickly, sometimes in a single setting, sometimes not, and can really give these patients a good outcome. So in my opinion, directly head-to-head against American College of Chest Physicians, I think that patients that have a good life expectancy, that are not gravely ill, that have an iliofemoral DVT should be considered for thrombolysis. The reason I say that is we're the guys that see these guys back in the clinic with the swollen, sore legs, constantly trying to get them in stockings, et cetera, and it's a real problem. But the problem is the Doppler doesn't say iliofemoral DVT, right? Never have I seen a Doppler report that says that. In fact, every report that I see here, external iliac vein says not seen or poorly visualized or something like that, and you're just left what's going on down below. But what you will see on these reports is it'll say that the common femoral vein does have thrombosis. and the veins tend to clot all the way up to at least the next branch. So if the common femoral vein is occluded, you can pretty much bet that it's going to be occluded all the way up into the iliac veins. So the marker that we look for on these is a common femoral vein thrombus. We don't generally do a CT with venous phases or an MRV for these. Usually the clinical signs can show you if they're swollen all the way up, and if the common femoral vein is occluded and it's not just a little short catheter thing, then that's the patient who's got this. So I think that's kind of one of the other important messages to take home from that. The other thing I'd say is that there are some patients that are very symptomatic with superficial femoral vein disease that are very active, and for those patients, this sometimes makes sense. We certainly have to talk to them about it. We know that they're not going to have as much benefit as somebody without, but many of these patients as well are left with lifetime stockings, which they may or may not be compliant with. So for some patients with this that are very active and have a great outlook otherwise, we will offer it to them, but with the caveats that they're expected outcome over anticoagulation is certainly not as good as it would be if they had a more extensive clot, and that there's certainly risk to it. But again, I would say iliofemoral DBT, good outcome in the patient, good outlook in the patient anyway, I think it should be should be offered to them. Part two, chronic venous insufficiency. And I tell you, I mean, as a surgery intern, there were two things you were guaranteed were your domain, right? One was Uniboot Clinic. And the other was that you're the guy who's like looking at anal fissures and fistulas and that kind of stuff. Those are the two things that nobody wants to mess with. So it's a real problem. And, you know, we've seen these patients and they've got these things. They're there all the time. They're really unhappy about it. Frequently they're heavy. They've been bounced around from doctor to doctor. And they're really frustrated folks. This lady's had this for 30 years. It's terrible. What's the problem with chronic venous insufficiency? If you kind of break it down and say, where are we at? Where's the problem coming from? What can we do to try and make this thing better? Then you can sort of get a handle on it, other than just saying, oh my God, just wrap a boot on, send them out. Hopefully they won't come back next time. Because that's seriously what we used to do. So reflux and obstruction, those seem to be the two things that are really the pathophysiology problems with the veins that are giving you your issues. The combination, clearly the worst, but fortunately most of these patients are refluxers alone. Most of these are not obstructed. The ones that are obstructed, those are hard guys to help. But fortunately, the majority of these have reflux as their primary pathology. And what it all comes down to is ambulatory venous hypertension. So the blood with the venous system is all supposed to go from your outer parts to your inner parts, right? So it's supposed to go from your superficial veins into your deep veins up to your heart. From your superficial veins through your perforating veins into your deep veins up to your heart. And that's supposed to be the flow. And if there's any kind of problem along the way, very small pressure changes, many times unmeasurable, can just throw off the whole system. And what we know is that your resting venous pressures are so low that a change of 2 millimeters or so can really throw the system out of whack. When we think about the venous segments and how we can approach this in terms of a diagnostic and therapeutic modality, think about the veins from the leg in 4 segments. The pelvic outflow, which we've just been looking at, the deep veins, which of course we all think about from our DVTs, et cetera, the superficial veins and the perforating veins. And if we look at them, so again, we've got our stuff up here. Our deep veins we know, right? It's been changed actually now, so the nomenclature has been changed and they're trying to get us to all call the superficial femoral vein now just the femoral vein, but it's a hard pill to swallow for many of us. But it's all because everybody was thinking of this as perhaps not a DVT if they said there was a clot in the superficial femoral vein and people weren't getting treated. So the recommendation came out that we change the name, but I must say I hate it because it's right by the superficial femoral artery, so it just makes sense to me that it'd be called the same with the vein. But I wasn't on that panel. So. We've got our deep system there. We've got our saphenous veins, which of course we use for coronary revascularization, leg revascularization, stake out at will for varicosities, et cetera. So our greater saphenous and our lesser saphenous veins, and there are perforating veins that connect the deep and superficial systems. And there tend to be veins that run all up and down the leg for perforating veins, but the biggest problem veins tend to be down close to the ankle where the problems are manifest. So if we talk about venous insufficiency patients, usually we're talking about a SEEP classification, which is kind of our fancy way of trying to break it down in some way that makes sense. And what you'll really talk about is the patients with advanced clinical classification. So we think about the C6 and C4 patients. So the patients with either active open ulcers have healed or have lots of the stasis dermatitis, hyperpigmentation, lipodermatosclerosis, et cetera. Patients with edema, never quite sure where these guys fit in. And then the varicose veins and stuff, we don't quite think of as badly. So in the evaluation, first things first, is it truly venous or not? And there are many patients that come in with leg sores, et cetera. Perhaps it's traumatic, perhaps it's vasculitic. Many of these patients have arterial insufficiency that compounds their problems. So not infrequently you need to test their arterial system and evaluate for systemic problems at the same time. If that's not it, if you think, okay, it is a venous ulcer, it looks like, it smells like, it gotta be it, then really what you need to evaluate the patient is a good reflex examination, not a DVT study. Too many times you'll send the patient in, they'll get a venous Doppler, comes back, no DVT. It took all of about 7 minutes for the tech to say that, and boom, they're back in your office and you have no more information that you can help. It just says normal, 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 and you're looking at this leg going, there's no way this is normal, right? Well, the problem is it's very easy to do a DVT study. It's not so easy to go and do a reflex study because you have to go and look at each of those venous segments and see, are they obstructed, are they refluxing, how bad are they refluxing, et cetera. All that being said, after evaluation, truly the mainstay of treatment for these patients remains compression therapy, because rarely can we cure them, many times we can make them better, and good wound care. And good wound care is totally paramount. And honestly, we don't even try to fake that in the clinic. I mean, there are so many wound centers around town that really to get these patients into one of the wound center programs, I think, is really fabulous. And we work with ones all over town. They're, I think for the most part, they do a really great service for the patients because they're set up to handle it and all the troubles that go with it. Long-term compliance with compressions, however, is exceedingly poor. You know, in a study, it's 90% plus, but this is Houston, right? It's hot as hell, it's sweaty, it's 90% humidity out there, and if you look at how people actually do with compressions outside of studies, it's a quarter at best that actually wear these things on a daily basis like you're telling them to. And that's been studied. It's just, it's hard to do it. Prolonged ulcer healing and recurrences are really the rule rather than the exception. Rarely did somebody just get right through their ulcer and then go on and not have any more problems. So if we look at the venous segments one by one, so the pelvic venous problems tend to be really obstructive, not refluxing. Usually the valves down in the femoral region will catch anything. Sometimes there's a valve, sometimes there's not in the iliacs, but really reflux here is not the issue. Here the issue is obstruction. And the two options basically are stenting, which we've talked about before, and here you can see the before and after of a stent case, and then perhaps sometimes a bypass. So this is somebody who actually had femoral vein ligated, had the extensive destruction of the iliac system, had a terribly swollen, disabling problem from the right leg. And we actually wound up doing a bypass, creating it with an AV fistula, which is why you see it enhanced so well, and that's stayed open now for a couple of years, and she's doing quite well. But surgical reconstruction is not really the thing that we do the most for that. It's almost all done now with angioplasty and stenting. The deep venous segment tends to really be our problem here. If it's obstructed, that's it. We really don't have any good way of fixing chronically obstructed deep venous segments. If it's a focal area, or perhaps there are some sneaky or something else, then we can open that up. But if it's got extensive thrombotic changes through the deep system, that's more or less a done deal. Bypass for the deep system down lower in the leg just really doesn't tend to work well, almost invariably occludes. The ones that don't occlude are really sort of glamorous case reports, and nobody else can really duplicate that. So even guys like Kistner have given that up. Now, if they're incompetent, then that's a little more intriguing. The trouble is, though, the surgeries to fix that are a fairly big deal, are associated with significant rate of causing thrombotic problems, which perhaps in some cases is not the worst, because in some cases having an occluded femoral vein rather than a refluxing one might actually be your friend if your problem is really venous hypertension down at the foot. But if you're sort of down that path where you've done all the easy things and those things aren't working, then to go and do deep venous reconstruction is possible. The two basic things are to try and go and actually repair the valve, where you sort of tighten up the leaflets, or to actually replace the valve, usually with the venous segment from the arm. The problem there is that the venous segment from the arm is usually an incompetent valve as well, and then it has to be tightened and treated, and the question is, you know, what's really the long term? With the other treatments that are offered, this is really something that's fallen down to where it's done in just a handful of cases across the country. It's just rarely done anymore. The other treatments seem to really work so much better, and I think the increasing recognition of pelvic venous outflow obstruction has led to this thing not being done nearly as much. But can be done, yes. In the future, having a percutaneous valve that you could place in here that would be non-thrombogenic, effective, and competent would really be a landslide victory for these guys, because this is a fairly difficult, tedious procedure that not everybody's able to do well, and if you could replace that with something simpler, it'd be great. Unfortunately, so far, the trials in man have not shown to be good. There's only a few that have been done sort of experimentally, and they really have problems with either thrombotic events or with becoming incompetent shortly after time. So the superficial veins treatments are really the ones that are relatively easy to do. Unfortunately, again, these patients' main problem for the majority of the patients is incompetence, not obstruction. So what can we do with the superficial veins? Well, stripping versus ablation are sort of the basic options. Stripping being shown here where an incision is in the groin, incision at the knee or else down at the ankle, a little device introduced, the vein tied around it, and then the vein extracted from the leg. The problem is, though, a couple of pictures like this get shown on the internet, and stripping suddenly is taboo. I mean, if you offer somebody stripping, they're like wondering what century you're from. You just can't sell stripping. It can't be done. That being said, modern-day stripping with tumescent anesthesia, performed in the clinic, obviously, et cetera, actually has excellent outcomes. And it's really gotten a worse name than it deserves. But the name is out there, and it's not going to be overcome, in my opinion. Ablation. It's sexy. You know, and people just, this is what they want. This is what they read about. This is what their neighbor had. And this is what they want to have done. So a small catheter is inserted into the incompetent vein. A catheter is threaded up. And then with ultrasound imaging, you're able to visualize where the connection is up here to the deep system. And using some sort of heat source, either laser or radio frequency ablation energy, draw back slowly and then ablate the vein. If you look at these long term, the efficacy winds up being just as good from the ablation as it does from the stripping, and patients get back to work quicker and do better, et cetera. So for the great majority of patients, they're going to go with ablation over stripping. The perforating veins are sort of the last thing in that four-component part. And it's a little bit controversial, honestly, about how much we need to treat them. You'll go to meetings and people are pretty passionate about one or the other, saying, yes, you should treat, no, you shouldn't treat. And I've kind of met both, and honestly, I don't know what the right answer is. And unfortunately, there were not really good randomized trials. What we know, though, is from the registries where patients have been treated, generally they do better with this. The problem is, though, almost always it's put in combination with some other treatments, and that makes it a little hard to evaluate. So what's been described to treat these perforating veins? Well, the first is a Linton procedure. And the problem is that filleting the leg and going and dividing these perforators individually in an area that's probably already inflamed, like you see here, leads to wound healing problems that are chronic, and that as well is a pretty hard sell. And just has been pretty well neglected and abandoned almost. It's been revised by making it through smaller incisions, but even so, you wind up having to make your incisions down close to where the area of induration is, and it's thick, woody, leathery skin that can be very difficult to get to heal well. SEPS is kind of the next step forward, and that actually was a pretty big boon for patients and was something that was done really widely and commonly and is really starting to fall away. So in that we're using remote access, so using laparoscopic or endoscopic technology, getting access up in the undiseased skin and then going down. The trouble is, though, where the real troublesome perforators are down here, the spaces that you're working become very tight, and it's difficult to work the little chopsticks down in that hole and actually divide the veins that are important that are right under the ulcerated area. You can try and get around that by putting in extra ports down lower, but it really becomes a little bit of an issue, and if we've followed patients long-term, we know that there's a significant recurrence rate to these perforating veins. It's kind of like varicose veins or spider veins. If it's somebody that makes veins and has venous troubles, they tend to keep making those veins down the road. And the problem with this is it really can't be repeated. Once you've gone in and dissected that space, to get back in there and redissect it in the future is nearly impossible. It gets really stuck down and bloody. So ablation has come along, and just like the ablation we were doing for the saphenous veins, there are now approved catheters for the perforating veins themselves, and then sclerotherapy is something that's emerging as well. So a perforator vein catheter is this, and what it is, you can see the sharp needle trocar, the two probes here are what the energy is delivered between, and then it's placed through a sheath. And just showing here, so here we're looking at the leg, we've got the fascia right here, and then we're just demonstrating that we've got flow going from this perforator where the perforating vein is going from the deep system out to the superficial. It's not usually going right to the saphenous, it's going to the posterior arch vein or some other superficial veins in the area, sometimes for the varicosity. And then we confirm the reflux in it, and this flow up here above is showing continued reflux, which is certainly greater than the half second that we'd like to demonstrate, showing that that's an issue. And here we come in with our probe, and with ultrasound imaging again, we watch the probe come directly in, and we're trying to spear that in that case. If the vein is situated that it's at an angle, many times we'll try and cannulate the vein and come down through it, but in one like this, obviously, to do that, you'd have to stick straight down through the patient. That's not quite right. So in this case, we've actually just speared it, and you can see where we're placing the two probes, the two knobs that you see right here, right on either side of the vein if we can. Turn on the generator, and usually we'll treat this for 2 to 4 minutes. And as you're doing it, you can see right here where the marker is, it's got a little sizzle going on. It's almost like bacon. You can feel the thing sizzling and cracking. It's kind of rewarding, actually. afterwards, then we'd do a nice little squeeze and see, have we done any good or not done any good? And what we can see here is we can visualize the perforator, but we don't see any flow, but we do see flow that's maintained through the deep system, and that's always rewarding because we don't want to cause DVTs. So with the advances, I think what it's really let us do is now with minimally invasive techniques, it's let us treat multiple segments at the same time. Previously, what would have happened to this patient is they would have gotten a vein stripping, waited to see. If that doesn't work, then they come back and they get a sepsis procedure, wait to see. If that doesn't work, then perhaps the ulcer gets debrided, skin grafted, that sloughs off, and then we kind of scratch our heads and figure out what to do, start wrapping the boots on and hope he goes away. But by doing this, we're able to do a fairly objective evaluation, treat the outflow obstruction, again, most times with angioplasty or stenting, treat the superficial incompetence and perforator incompetence, more or less all percutaneously. So they're not just stuck with Una boots and ulcers forever. And really, if you investigate these patients carefully, you can frequently find venous pathology that you can fix or at least make better. But the one thing I tell them is they're rarely cured. They've almost always got some underlying troubles. The deep system is a problem. Most times, though, if we'll treat the superficial system, the perforating system, the outflow, that's enough. And in fact, some people would argue if you just treat the superficial veins, that's enough. We find that we can do all of it in a minimally invasive fashion. We can do it all in one setting. It's more cost-effective for the patient, so we do it all at one shot, and then the patient's got their best shot that we can deliver at healing. And this is a happy leg. When it's going from something like this, it's been there for so long, the big heaped-up edges, and now to a healed wound, that's a happy patient. Just briefly, I'm going to talk about a new clinical trial that's coming this way, starting soon. Verisolve is a drug, essentially, that's being tried out now here in the U.S. Polidocanol is the sclerosin that's used the most worldwide for AVMs, varicosities, et cetera, but is not approved here in the U.S. And there's a new protocol that's coming up to treat superficial incompetence with this. That's not a brand new concept. Foam sclerotherapy is certainly done all the time in Europe. Foam sclerotherapy is done here in the U.S. off-label with different drugs, occasionally done with this one. But then you have to compound to get people to ship it in from Canada, et cetera, and it's probably not so good. And the hope is that you can train this person into that person. So how it's done, actually, is that we access the vein. We've got our stuff mixed up, and then we infuse the stuff through here. Watch with ultrasound. When it comes up close to the saphenofemoral junction, then compress on the junction and get it to reflux back down the leg. And then fill up the tributaries and hopefully take care of the varicosities at the same time it's doing the other. The differences between this and the stuff that people make in the office is people will just take air, room air, mix it up with usually STS or sodium orate and sort of go back and forth, back and forth, and they've got a little syringe full of foam. This is made with oxygen, actually, so it's more soluble than just room air when it hits the bloodstream, which it's going to at some point. It's greater consistency, more predictable effect. And then what happens is that this foam acts like a piston. It displaces the blood as it comes through the system and then distributes evenly and gets better contact to the outer wall. People previously were trying to do sclerotherapy of the saphenous vein with liquid sclerosants, but you had to use big volumes. It didn't contact the wall and just really didn't work that well, especially for the bigger veins. And then what happens is it attacks the endothelial lining, causes sclerosin, causes initially just some spasm, and then eventually occlusion, and then sometimes resorption, or sometimes it just seems to form into a little bit of a scar. So if you look at previous study results that have been done in Europe, what we'll find is that for varicose vein resolution compared to stripping, it's not quite as effective, fairly close, but surgery certainly suggested that it had more problems with pain and swelling and return to work. Compared to sclerotherapy, which is done simply in the office and they go on about their stuff. Compared to liquid sclerotherapy, less failures, less injections, and certainly does better over time, and that's been published. DVT from the early experience was a problem, fairly rare problem, but still a problem. If you look at any patients who treated for superficial venous incompetence with stripping or whatever, there's certainly an incidence of DVT. It's fairly low, and then since this came out, they changed the protocol that they move the sclerosant further down, and they don't let it get as close to the saphenofemoral junction as they used to. And since that time, they've had no further DVTs in their experience abroad. Now, this really came to light, though, last year in JVS when it was reported that a patient had a stroke after foam sclerotherapy for their saphenous vein. And in this case, this is one of the hand-mixed things. It actually was polidocanol, again, not approved, but polidocanol, but a hand-mixed thing. And then what happened was that the gas particles embolized through a patent foramen ovale, went up to the head, and then caused a stroke that way. That being said, the FDA, of course, has had a fit about these guys trying to get this particular agent approved now here. Even though people are using it and using it off-label, it's a problem. So the whole point of the study is, in patients with a PFO, do bubbles actually go through and go up to the brain and cause either clinical or subclinical events? Again, the argument against this is that thousands of patients have been treated with polidocanol and foam square therapy across the world. Rarely is stroke ever an issue. And with this particular agent, we know that over 100 patients have been treated with this combination with the protocol and have not had any strokes. So again, the problem with the PFO is that the things can cross from right to left and then embolize up or out. So the plan for this study is to find patients with significant varicose veins and saphenous reflux having foramen ovales and right to left shunts, get baseline screening studies on the patients, treat 50 patients, and then follow them up afterwards and see what the outcome is. Obviously, a single event is probably going to keep this drug from ever getting approved in the U.S. It's had this much trouble getting it to this point. But overall, we think the chance of having real problems is very small. Interesting enough, if you talk to people that do a lot of this, you'll find that patients do have some transient visual changes, that they'll find that they're a little lightheaded or something, which is a little spooky, honestly. So how are we going to find the PFOs and look for emboli? It's actually with transcranial Doppler, which is sort of a renewed and sort of a new interest of us here now. And we've added specialists in our department for that. So as you look through, you can see both the flow coming out the middle cerebral, going up the anterior cerebral on the same side, and then coming up the other. So you'll see antegrade, retrograde, and antegrade flow again. And you'd hope to see it just like this, that you've got nice flow. If you have emboli from bubbles, so if you just have an IV running in somebody, you'll frequently see these bubbles going through the brain. Almost never do they cause any problems. The other point of the study is that with this more dissolvable gas and more rapid absorption of it and the smaller size, we think the chance of having clinical sequelae from this is going to be minimal. But if you look with a bubble test, you will certainly see that people do show evidence of air emboli during studies. And so here's a patient that's getting tested out to the side. They're mixing up the gas with the saline and then going to inject that. And there he goes. And now we're waiting. And sure enough, now you hear the bubbles come through. So the person didn't just drop their right side or have a big stroke, but sure enough, you can find PFOs and detectable anyway, angiographically or sonographically, that you can have bubbles going through. So that's what we'll be doing, to look and see if they do have PFOs, then we'll be treating the veins and see how they go. Obviously, it's a fairly big deal, informed consent process, et cetera, and it may be that it's just not going to take off. I think, though, if people compare how people have done across the world, in reality, this is probably a pretty benign procedure. And then TCD, we're using also in combination with our carotid Dopplers, trying to predict which lesions are causing emboli, and perhaps they're setting the patients at higher risk for stroke. So it may be that we can actually use TCD in patients that have 50% lesions to say, is this one that's likely breaking off little pieces and could break off a big piece, or is this one that's rock stable and after 20 minutes we see nothing coming up? The same if we're worried about any clot that's left on valves, et cetera, or patients with AFib that don't want to take their anticoagulation. If you can show them, if they're having lots of small hits going up, even though they're subclinical, perhaps that's somebody that should be anticoagulated and would help talk them into it. So that's it. That's the whirlwind tour of the venous disease and updates going on. Happy to answer any questions. Dale.
It's a great talk, Harry. I have a question about stents in the veins. Okay. I noticed you had one example of a fairly extensive, fairly long stent in the left iliac. It extended across the bifurcation, actually somewhat crossed the flow of the right iliac vein coming in. And, you know, veins are low flow systems. It would seem to me that they're going to be more thrombogenic than stents in arteries. So the question is, have there been any controlled studies comparing, I realize local stents for local strictures or stenoses make a lot of sense, but have there been any controlled studies with stents and no stents for long-term patency?
I guess I would say that the probably not well-controlled studies, but the series that are reported with angioplasty alone are abysmal results. And it simply doesn't work to just angioplasty the vein alone. It has to be stented because it is a low-flow system with a little bit of obstruction that's still residual in there. It's going to be so slow that it's just going to clot up over time. Interestingly enough, that's been a huge concern of people is, can you put this stent over across the right iliac vein, right? The people that have the biggest experience of this, probably in the world actually, are in Jackson, Mississippi, and that's Raju and Naglin, and they've done now 1,000 and something stents in the iliac venous system. I mean, if you go into that place, you're coming out with a stent, whether you're carrying the mail in or why you're there. But strangely, their failures are the ones that don't extend into the cava. So now, in fact, they always go into the cava, always cross the other side, and rarely ever see anything happen on the other side. The incidence of getting a contralateral DVT without some other existing pathology that's already there is single digit. It's incredibly small. And it's a little counterintuitive because you think, how in the world is that going to happen? But it's a huge stent. I mean, keep in mind, these are like 22, 24 millimeter stents. I mean, these are not little coronary jobs. And crossing the lesion or crossing the normal side is the rule rather than the exception. And it maintains the patency. It doesn't affect the other side.
And two other questions related to the same subject. One is, do they develop a pseudo-enema or do they develop an enema so that after 3 months, you can think about stopping the anticoagulation, or do you have to continue it ad nauseum? And two, do you worry about placing a stent across a joint or across the inguinal ligament?
So I guess number two, I certainly worry about crossing it across a joint, but I'll tell you, in the cases where you don't, where you think, oh, I'm not going to cross the joint, I'm going to leave it up in the pelvis, and I'm just going to plasty that stuff at the bottom, clot. Universal clot. If you don't stent through the lesion, if you don't fix whatever is still a problem after you've done your DVT or your thrombolytic work, it's going to fail. It just does not stay open. And, you know, 30% or less lesion is probably okay, but certainly 50% or more, no way. It's just not going to stay open. So you need to extend down, and you can extend right down to the femoral vein or superficial femoral vein, whatever you choose to call it, and that tends to prolong the patency better. Do they get covered with the pseudoentema? They do, certainly, right? They get relined, and you can see that just like any other stent. Fortunately, they're so big, it takes a long time for them to occlude with that way. The long-term patency of these seems to, or the mid-term patency of these, I should say, seems to be really good. We know that at a year, 90-plus percent of these are open. We know that at 5 years, about 70 to 80% of these are still open, and the great majority of patients remain asymptomatic. But we do continue their anticoagulation depending on what their pathologic problem was before. If they just come in and they've got ulcers or something like that and I see the May Thurner, then I don't anticoagulate those people. I only anticoagulate the post-thrombotic patients.
Eric, you've advocated a different treatment that most of us would consider for patients who have iliofemoral clot. Most of us think of getting a patient either anticoagulated or getting a filter above, and then most physicians, they probably forget about it. And your argument then has been that there's a high incidence of post-phlebitic syndrome. How common is that for patients to have significant leg swelling or develop venostasis who have iliofemoral clot that's treated just with anticoagulation?
Yeah, so the numbers there kind of range, of course, depending on who you read. I'd say the current series that are out would probably say that's somewhere around 30 to 40%. The historical controls that we use to compare other trials say that that's about 60%, that they're going to be left with abnormal leg, that their leg hurts, their leg's a little swollen, not necessarily that they get ulcers. Ulcers are a relatively rare occurrence in those patients. It's much more common to have a little bit swollen, a little bit achy, a little bit tight, and then some lipodermatosclerosis, but not too common to go on and get ulcerations. Ulcerations is 10% or less.
Craig kind of threw in a little curveball in there of the IVC filter. I mean, if you take out everything else and just talk about the IVC filter and its risk for phlegmasia and venous insufficiency, what is that?
Well, that's a problem, right? And what we know is that, you know, there's a randomized trial that was published, I guess, 2 years ago now in New England Journal that showed if you have a leg clot and then you come in, you're going to get anticoagulated, not anticoagulated, filter, no filter. The patients that got a filter had an early decrease in their PE rate, right? But long-term, they had a more than doubling of their chance of recurrent DVT. And that's a huge issue, and that's sort of one of the things that spurred on this development and marketing of removable or optional filters. So we're pretty reluctant to put a filter in somebody that has an extensive DVT and not anticoagulate. I think, you know, that's a pretty good recipe for disaster for that to extend up and then be a real problem. But it becomes a real trouble in patients that can't be properly anticoagulated, right? They're non-compliant with their medications, et cetera. Those patients are really difficult to deal with. It's a little hard to know from an observational standpoint or natural history how those patients do, because you don't find that many to follow them out long term. But certainly we see a number here that have had a big DVT, got a filter placed, no anticoagulation, and then their big DVT becomes a much bigger DVT, and then they are left with phlegmasia or incapacitating leg problems. So filter alone, we tend to go against. And certainly if you talk to the hematologists, they hate filters, right? Dr. McCarthy and Rice, they'd give you a foul look if you even mention filter. Because truly, with anticoagulation, most patients are protected from pulmonary emboli. And if you do have to do it, I think the retrievable filters are probably the way to go, unless you really have somebody who's going to be bedridden and never going to get up again. And that person, who knows, DVTs may not be such a big deal. They won't get swollen. Thanks for your attention.